So let's turn to our topic tonight, equity markets, the view from Silicon Valley. Chuck's been on the Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin and I several months ago. But to introduce him again, in 2010, I had some of my investment advisory clients in a fund that was managed out of Zurich, which I liked very much. And as the Americans brought more and more pressure on the Swiss, a decision was made to send the American investors' money back. And so I started in 2010 in anticipation of this happening, doing a search for a fund that could replace the one that we had. And I searched and searched and tore my hair out because I just couldn't find anything. And one day I was sitting in Chuck's office meeting with him because he helps manage some of my clients' money. And I said, you know, I trust you and me to manage this more than any other fund I can find. And I really just said it facetiously off the top of my head. And then one thing led to another, and the result was we created C-Lane Advisory, which is a partnership of Solari Advisors and Chuck's money management company, Financial Perspectives, or I should say Investment Advisor. Chuck and I spend about 2 hours a day in investment committee every day, 5 days a week, looking at investment trends in companies. Because C-Lane is in the San Francisco Bay Area, next to Silicon or in Silicon Valley, and Chuck is an engineer who started on the IT side of Silicon Valley before moving to investment advisory, it's not surprising that we spend quite a lot of time analyzing what is happening in the high-tech part of the domestic and global equity markets. And it was I finally realized one day sitting, working with Chuck on these various topics, that I realized that it was very important for me to start to bring this information to our subscribers so that they could understand these developments. And so I asked Chuck, and Chuck has graciously agreed to join us regularly, which we'll be doing quarterly on the Solari Report. So with that, let me invite Chuck to join us. Chuck, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just great. Okay, so technology and innovation is a primary trend. What do you think?
Well, like you said, it's here and it's now, and you have to embrace it because if you don't, it's going to take over your life one way or the other.
Well, I knew when I said to somebody when Franklin Sanders got an iPhone, I said, well, I guess it's here to stay. Well, but before we dove in, I just wanted to start a little bit because one of the things I noticed, you know, I travel around the country a lot. I really notice how much certain areas of the country are economically doing very much better than others. And one of the reasons you see it around Austin, Texas, and in Texas, you see it in the Boston area, and you certainly see it in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley. One of the things is an area a leader in the new technology and innovation that's happening. And so it's not just something that's having a dramatic impact on equity markets. It's really having a dramatic impact on places, and certainly in the United States, what I see is a real sort of, I don't know, it's sort of a division in the economy between places that are staying current on technology and places that are falling behind. But certainly, I must say, when you're out in Silicon Valley, you know, it doesn't feel like there's any recession out there.
No, and even in 2008, 2009, it would not be unusual to go to a restaurant on the weekends and find that, you know, they were packed, or at lunchtime they were still packed. It was like nothing was happening. It was really strange. It wasn't quite that bad, but you wouldn't have known that it was a severe recession that it really was. So And I've been on the East Coast too, in the Boston area, where you have, you know, strong technological ties, and they were somewhat impacted like the Bay Area. So it's those areas that, like you said, that are, you know, strong technology and are embracing it, that are tending to do very well, or much better, let's say.
Well, I remember when I was out in Pleasanton and they announced the Facebook IPO, and every weekend on Sunday night, the Mercedes dealerships would all be packed. I kept saying, oh, there's no recession here. Okay, well, let's start. Let's just dive into the key areas. I should tell everyone that Chuck and I sat down, and I said, okay, first I want to make a list of all the different areas that will be dramatically impacted by new technology. And then I want to call from that the areas that will be relevant to the equity investor, because there are a lot that really impact us as a human being or as a citizen of a sovereign country, because a lot of them get into government areas that government oversees. But we just wanted to focus tonight on those that seem to be making a real impact on the equity markets both now and that we anticipate in the future. So that helps limit this list to a more manageable list. But the first one is one that Chuck knows an awful lot about. So, Chuck, I'm going to defer a lot to you. And that's the switch from desktop computing to what we call going mobile. So maybe if you could just give us an overview of this.
Yeah, and this started, I hate to tell you how long it was before I actually got into the investment advisory business, but this was when I was in the corporate world, one of the things that I was focused on, and that is the convergence of the phone, the computer, and the TV. And we were working on it back in the 80s and 90s, and it's still going on, and technology is advancing, and it's amazing how much faster what we've been able to progress in the last 5 years is way over what we were able to progress in the first 20 years of this convergence. But it is the convergence of those things, and right now the interim step of all of that really is the smartphone and the tablet. And we still have some improvements to go, but at some point in time, and I don't think it's going to be that far in the future, we're going to see, a device or two devices at the most where you'll be able to do all of those things. You'll be able to make a call on it. You'll be able to go to your office. You'll be able to plug it into a docking station, and it will be your computer. You'll leave the office if you ever get that opportunity to go home to visit your family, and it will follow you wherever you go. You'll be able to watch TV. You'll be able to do everything from it. And we're there today. It's just that we have pieces of not only the devices themselves, but the network to be able to provide that capability is not caught up yet. But we're getting there.
I put a slide up on the teleseminar, and it's a slide that shows us going from mainframe computers in 1960 to the desktop in 1990 to 2000, and then the mobile internet computing and the explosion in the number of units that is happening. It's really quite extraordinary. You know my fantasy about William Gibson has a book called Mona Lisa Overdrive, and in it the protagonist, who's the daughter of a Yakuza chieftain, is his young daughter, has a handheld personal assistant, and out of it pops a hologram of a British butler who can answer any question and do anything for you that you could possibly imagine. And so I'm hoping it gets to the point where I get my English butler.
Yeah, maybe in a few years. We're
maybe
getting
in
there.
A few years. Okay. Okay. So
I find this graph really exciting, because at some point I looked at this and I said, how can this be? How can we have continued growth in the number of units that are actually being utilized when the number of users that actually don't have those units is shrinking? And what I'm finding out is, you dig a little deeper, you're finding that, for example, corporate world has a single type of phone, and most of them aren't quite there with Apple, so they'll have either a BlackBerry, or they'll have an Android phone, and then people are on their own are buying a second phone, an iPhone. And so that answers, at least in the short term, why this logarithmic growth will continue to go for probably another, the rest of this decade.
I just put up the chart on the explosive growth in mobile data traffic. I don't know if you've seen it come up yet, but it goes from 2011 to 2016 and shows the estimates of how much the traffic itself is going to grow. And I think part of this, is the availability of video and video working over a mobile device. Is that true?
Yeah, it is, and because it takes up so much more data. The interesting thing is, I think if you had the networks to be able to support this the actual data traffic would grow greater than what they're projecting.
Right. And of course, one of the really big things, let me pull up the mobile payment growth. One of the big things is that this is not just data, but now we're talking about more and more transactions being done online and from a mobile device. So I have that up. And it says global mobile payment transactions expected to rise to $940 billion, so almost $1 trillion in 2015. So if today it's approximately $100 billion, we're talking about a multiple of, 10 times by 2015. That's an extraordinary shift of our transactions onto these mobile devices.
And that's a, that's a growth rate of almost 100% a year. So you can see why there is so much flurry of activity around mobile and mobile payments, because it's here and now, and it's similar to the environment we had, I keep using this example of, when VCRs were first introduced to the world, and it was a matter of there were two camps that were, two competing camps for technologies, and, VHS they beat out beta, but right now there is no clear winner on which technology or which technological path that they're going to use to be able to use for this mobile payments. And so it's a little early to know who it is that's going to win, but whoever wins, you can see that the amount of money that's being flown into the sector is unbelievable. And I think it's important, though, to notice that this is about mobile payments, not about mobile banking, because there's a clear distinction. Mobile payments is the actual payment of a purchase that you've made. Mobile banking is the ability to do your banking, go to your checking account and move money or something like that. Now, that's already available, but the payments are currently in their infancy.
Now, they call it a wallet when you have the ability to put money on your mobile device that you can spend.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's right. Go ahead.
And Apple is supposed to come out with a new wallet this fall. Is that the case?
Yeah.
All
the eyes are on Apple right now.
Right. Right. I suspect one of the reasons the stock has moved up as much as it has is anticipation of Apple. I think that there are people who are hoping Apple's going to be the winner on the payment side. Well, what are the challenges of getting to this place where everything can be done mobile? And what does that mean to the companies that are going to try and address those challenges?
Well, obviously the first one that comes to my mind, and I know it's a sensitive issue for you, is the security part of it.
Right.
How do you protect a person's identity, their information, because all of this information is going to be stored on your device, and devices get lost, they get stolen. How do you protect that? And it's kind of no different than a credit card, but because that's really what the payment system is all about. It's not, you don't necessarily have to have a wallet like you and I might think about it, where you have dollars or paper currency sitting in that wallet that you're allowed to spend. The actual wallet can, in terms of mobile payments, is really like an account that you can debit against or a credit card that you can charge against. So it's not necessarily a wallet as we think about, but that is another pathway that they're electing to look at.
What about getting video to go through the mobile system, both in terms of what you need in terms of networks and what you need on the device itself?
Yeah, the threshold, well, you've got twofold problems there. One is the current networks to be able to stream video. Now, they can, but it's not high-definition video, and, of course, we're about one or two generations behind in the ability for the networks to be able to stream the type of video that we're used to viewing on a big-screen TV. But, that will come. They're changing technologies about every 2 or 3 years with regards to the generations of of the network. So I would expect the next generation or the one after that for able to see high def, you know, 1080p type of video. But that being said, I don't know if you have a phone, you know, a payment or a bill that gives you unlimited data, that's great. But if you ever tried to watch a movie or something, they charge you on a, you know, a per bit type of a basis, and that becomes very, very expensive. So I'm not sure how they're going to be able to deal with this, even though they, even when they do have the capability and have the bandwidth to be able to stream all of the information that people want to stream. It's, I could see it just becoming very cost prohibitive.
I pulled up the 24/7 graph, and this is my, this is a graph you found that I just love. It shows the going from a world of desktop intelligence, where we're spending 3 hours a day on average at the desktop, to one of mobile intelligence where, you know, the internet is accessing us and we're communicating, you know, every waking minute. In fact, I just sent an article to be posted on the blog about somebody who went on a media diet and stripped their phone of all the apps and made a commitment to shut their phone off, you know, 10 hours a day. And but you're talking about a very different relationship between, you know, me as an individual and the internet and online access. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, and you know what I find interesting about this is that there are entrepreneurs out there that are going to look at this chart and say, I got a six-hour window. I can try and find a way to squeeze in there and get access to this person, because from 12 a.m. to 6 a.m., they seem to be free of, you know, maybe I can make that from 12 to 5 or
right.
1 to 6. So that's where this is, you know, there's going to be a way that you know that something's going to come up. They're going to be able to invade that six-hour peace and quiet that you have. It's going to be 24/7.
Yeah, one of the an engineer this week said to me, you know, we're going from a world of desktop intelligence to mobile intelligence to ambient intelligence, where if the networks integrate into everything, you know, it's not that we have this online world that's one world and this world we walk around in, you know, a place-based world and the material world, but the two are going to get integrated in this process. And I think that has enormous consequences, you know, both positive and negative. I know one of the things we struggle with is there's certainly a lot of people making apps and there's certainly a lot of people doing social media and games, but it's yet to be clear to us how any of that turns into a business. You know, it's something I struggle with, and I think, you know, if you watch what's happening to Facebook stock, it's clear they're struggling with it too. Anything you want to say?
Yeah, you know what? You know what's interesting, Catherine, is the, you talked about that, and you go back to the payments portion, and that's going to, as soon as they figure out which technology they're going to use or technologies they're going to use, that's going to be commoditized, because there are going to be hundreds of millions or billions of transactions. Because if you looked at the number of dollars that are associated with that, we said almost a trillion in, what was it, 2016 or 2015, the average payment, the average payment that's going to be made is less than $10.
Right.
So if you take that $1 trillion and divide by $10, that will tell you how many individual transactions. So you can see that for somebody that gets paid on a per transaction basis, or somebody that gets paid as a percentage of the amount of money that they're, you know, transacting, it's going to be a huge amount of money. They're inserting themselves between you, the payer, and the payee, and they're going to extract their fair share. And it's we're talking huge sums.
Well, it's amazing, because it shows you the power of micropayments when you get enough of them going. So it's a, you know, it's a micropayment world. One of the videos I didn't put up on the blog was Google's Project Glass One Day, but it shows somebody walking around. I think they've got their computer in their eyeglass or something. It's very, you know, it's very, to me, it's just very invasive technology. But it will give you a sense of some of this integration, and I think is maybe worth looking at. And let me see if I can't pull up the next graph.
While you're doing that, let me just touch on games real quick, because, you know, right now in 2011, there was about $5 billion worth of sales revenue generated from the sale of games for mobile devices. And that's projected to be triple that, $16 billion in 2016. Now, the interesting thing is that, you know, people will prefer to get these things for free, and they're going to pay a very small amount for the games themselves. But what's interesting is that currently about a third of the revenue is based on things that you buy when you're in the game. So if you're playing a game and you want to buy, you know, a credit or something that's a part of the game, that's about a third of the money of that $5 billion. But that is projected to grow to over a half in 2016. So the money that's the way they're going to monetize this. They're going to do it through not only the purchase of a game, but also through getting you hooked into that game, and those hooks are going to have things that you can buy in the game to take, you know, to go to the next level. And so it's going to be interesting.
Right.
It's kind of a cool way that they're going to, you know, for those that are gamers, or how they're going to generate revenue.
Well, part of it to me gets back to this micropayment, because if you can make it easy to do a tiny amount, you know, people are much more willing to take a chance on tiny amounts and try things.
Yep.
So if you can make it really easy and cheap to do micropayments, it opens up, you know, what I would call the long tail. Okay, well, I pulled up the chart, the rise and rise of data. But clearly what this means isn't just an explosion of data driven by the growth in mobile gadgets and the shift to mobile computing. And even I can't even explain to you what an exabyte is.
Well, that's funny. I had to look it up because I didn't want to not know the answer to that. But just to tell you, that is 1 followed by 18 zeros.
Wow. So 129 exabytes by 2016.
Yes. So you can see that not only there's two things that come out of that. One is how you can have a network that can be able to transmit all that information. But secondly, which is, you know, another topic that we will eventually need to talk about, is how do you manage all that? Where's it going and how do you manage it? Not only you as an individual, but the entire system, if it's not just information that's thrown away, how do you store it? How do you keep it? How do you manage it?
And why don't you just give an introduction to the notion of the cloud? And what the cloud is, and connect it to why it's happening.
You know, the cloud is one of those things that people either embrace, or it's very polarized topic, because there are those that want to preserve their privacy, and the cloud, the data is up there. If you can get a hacker to hack into it, you're going to get everything that you have up there is going to be exposed. And so that's one thing that those that you know, not don't favor the cloud, you know, have concerns about. But those that do, the data is so large, the only way you're going to be able to start to manage that is through, you know, nested types of servers that can control, store, and you can get at that data. Because think about, if you're a large corporation, you have just unbelievable amount of data. Are you going to store that? You know, where do you store that? How do you get at it? How do you have access? How do you manage it? And the cloud allows you to do that most efficiently, because if you have unused resources, you can borrow ones. You can maybe borrow some resources that people aren't using from another company. So all you're doing is borrowing their space and their computing power. And the cloud allows you that advantage of being able to get efficient use of computing power and space.
Well, it's funny. I'm one of those people who's completely distrustful of the cloud, as you know. And I think, you know, if you look at the various things that are needed for the kind of world the technology is moving towards, you know, we need clouds that are trustworthy. And yet what we've seen is, you know, so far the online world has yet to prove itself to be something that's reliable or trustworthy. So it's going to be interesting to see how we create something that can be trusted. Well, let's turn to integration into the infrastructure. One of the DVDs I put up was, which is our second area, and that's computing, not just shifting from the desktop to the handheld device, but shifting out of the handheld device and integrating into the general infrastructure. And one of the things that makes this possible is what is called smart materials. And I put up a DVD from Corning called A Day Made of Glass that gives an example of integration of this kind of smart technology throughout the infrastructure, into the housing, into the cars, sort of into the furniture even. Maybe if you could sort of introduce smart materials, what's happening and what's driving this?
Yeah, on that, I'm not really all that, I haven't spent a whole lot of time in studying that. And so it is interesting, especially that, what I have done is looked at that Corning. And it, because if you look at what they've done with glass and the ability to use that in all aspects of all your phones, your computers, your TVs, everything has glass made in it. And it's now almost a part of all of these, we're talking about mobile. It's almost a part of every single mobile and technological advance that we as humans are, interfacing with every single day, because it's the digital that has to be converted to the analog, and the analog is what we use as a visual. So the actual glass part of it is the analog part, where it's transmitting the analog data, which you pick up with your eyes. It's really interesting, and in fact, the growth is just unbelievable.
Now, what does nanotechnology have to do with the smart materials? And what is nanotechnology?
Well, nanotechnology, I love this topic, but it, again, is one of those polarizable topics. I don't know where I have this vision of somebody introducing nanoparticles into your body and it going in and eating your brain. I don't know, it was some movie, a horror movie I must have seen or something. But, there are some really cool things going on in nanotechnology right now. And I don't know if you have seen the one, the titanium jaw that was put up from the University of Hasselt out of Belgium. So they had this titanium jaw was printed from, nanoparticles, from particles, and they were able to implant this in a person, and they were able to then, within 24 hours, swallow and talk normally. And I think that,
wow,
that is unbelievable. Additionally, here's a couple of other examples I thought.
And wasn't it somebody in their 70s? It was a senior.
Yeah, it was.
That
makes it even more difficult. There's a company down in Florida that is actually using nanoparticles to create filtration, basically filters. And the reason why that's really good is because nanoparticles are the smallest things that you can do. So once you combine these things together, they allow you to have an unbelievable filtration rate. And they're able to get to 99.49% of all things out of water. So you could say you could use this in a practical manner of taking a portable little filter that is made of nanoparticles, going to a country or a place where they don't have potable water, and be able to use this to filter water and then have it drinkable.
Now, isn't nanotechnology manufacturing and engineering at a molecular and submolecular level?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Okay.
So, there are a few other things, like the sports, there's a couple of sports equipment companies that they're making, so one of them is making, they're putting nano coatings on tennis balls. And these tennis balls with the nano coatings bounce twice as long as a regular ball, but not only that, it substantially improves their life in a tennis match. And they're also using it in golf clubs where you can actually get a lower density and higher strength club that allows for longer and straighter shots, which, of course, all of us golfers would love to see. And in even, a more practical life for some of you men out there, they're actually using nanoparticles for packaging on beer bottles. So this allows them to have thinner materials, and it makes the actual, the beer itself, not the beer, but the beer plus the container, lighter. So it's cheaper to ship, and it also extends the life of the beer on a shelf.
That's amazing. And the thing that amazes me is when you start digging in and looking at the different companies doing these things, I don't know if it would technically fit under nanotechnology, but with materials, you and I were looking at a company that makes plastic braces, and if you've ever had a kid or a friend who had to wear those metal braces, it's kind of a small application you never think about, but it could make such a big difference in everybody's life. So there are thousands and thousands and thousands of these lighter, stronger materials, of the things they can do. Well, let's turn to another area in integration into the infrastructure, because one of the things that people are talking about is machine-to-machine coordination and artificial intelligence. So I talked a couple weeks ago about the report in Kiplinger's that cars were going to talk to each other and talk to the highways, and we didn't need drivers to drive. You know, we could all sit and work on our way to the office because the car would drive. And my immediate reaction is so far the world of software has relatively been the Wild West, and entrepreneurs are sort of cowboys, and it hasn't been a world that is sort of engineered for very high-quality risk management. But now we're talking about going into a world where, you know, one small flaw in the network or in the software can result in a, you know, 100-car smash-up on the L.A. freeway in that kind of world. So it's a very, very different quality control and culture, to me, that's gonna emerge if this is going to happen, because we're talking about some pretty significant risk issues.
Yeah, you know, a good example of that would be what we have here, the BART, Bay Area Transit. So there are multiple trains running on, you know, a track or two, and they have to, the software controls their ability so that, you know, obviously they don't smash into each other. And the complexity of that software was, it took them years and years to be able to create. I can't imagine how complex it would be to be able to do that when you've had got hundreds or thousands of cars running together all at different speeds at different times, you know, coming and going in different directions. On a train, you've only got, you know, one direction one way and the other. You've only got basically two directions that you can go, and there's usually very few of those trains running at the same time. So, I'm with you on that one. I'm not sure I want to be the first person to be in the car to test that system out.
Well, it's funny. Somebody said to me today, I'd rather deal with the software issues than deal with drunk drivers. So maybe it's a little bit safer when the drunk drivers turn on their software, their autopilot. Okay, well, let's turn to manufacturing, our third area. It was interesting. I've done surveys of various team members and colleagues this week, and this is the area that seems to cause the most excitement, and that is we're really using technology to create a whole new generation of tools, and one which you've already mentioned, but I want to talk about again, is 3D printers. So maybe if you could just introduce for us, what is a 3D printer?
Yes, 3D printing. It's basically the process of making a 3D solid object from a digital model, and it's if you think about current manufacturing, it is a it's a subtractive process. So if you're building a car, you have a sheet of metal and you drill some holes in it to make it fit, and that's a subtractive. You start with something, you take something out of it, and it fits into, you know, through machining, it fits into your whatever it is that you're building, where a 3D printing is basically an additive process. So you start laying, so you have a two-dimensional object, and you start laying down that third dimension, which is, you know, so you've got length and width, and now you're going to add the depth part of it. So it is just, it's pretty simple. You create a 3D model, and that 3D model is then communicating information on each one of those layers to a 3D printer, and it lays down, it starts and basically lays it down from a 2D, your 2D layer to, and then it just starts building on top of each other.
So you just literally produce the DVD we have up on the, or the video we have up on the blog, is you just print yourself off a new wrench.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. And to go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, there are, for example, Audi uses the 3D printer on the prototype models of their cars. So they used to go out and have stuff, you know, they create a prototype, and you go through many iterations because you're going to want to make changes along the way. And it's very cost prohibitive to be able to go out, and when you make a small change, you have to go in and rebuild a whole bunch of components. Here, the model's already built. They make a minor change to the software. They hit the send button, and it goes to a printer, and it prints a brand new whatever it is that they want to build, and they can put it into the car and test out, see how it works. It's unbelievable how much faster, cheaper, and easier it is to fix, you know, or to be able to use in these kinds of environments.
So, it, needless to say, it makes it much cheaper to try things.
Yes. Yeah, and, okay. And over time, when you're going to use this thing in a production mode, it'll become cheaper to do it that way, too. But right now, this is so new and in its infancy that people are using it just in prototypes, and it is clearly the best way to do it for this type of model.
Okay, so two other things worth mentioning. One is lasers and robotics. Anything you wanted to mention there?
No, I know this is your love, so I tend to leave this to you because you're the champion on lasers and robotics.
Well, I put up one video, and in fact, somebody pointed out, well, you know, those guys really work off a joystick, so it's not technically a robot. But what I've seen happening, what we've seen happening in the last decade is more and more manufacturing can be done with robots instead of with humans, and it's dramatically bringing down the cost of manufacturing all sorts of stuff, and including making it more attractive to manufacture in the United States. So there are tremendous advantages of being close to your market. So let's say you're selling into the United States or you're selling into China, and having this technology makes it much easier to do a smaller footprint manufacturing and be close to home and be much speedier. And so I think the big question here is, will this allow manufacturing to stay in the United States and in the developed worlds, or even move back in, particularly with some of the increased political tensions between the United States and Asia? So to me, The Economist had a wonderful article in the spring of this year called The Third Industrial Revolution, and that's up on the blog. They talk a lot about taking these technologies and what it can do to really bring manufacturing. And we had a couple, several Solaria reports. We had Dale Dougherty from Sonoma, who's the sort of founder and leader of the maker movement. And the other thing that's happening is these tools are now getting to the point where a group of people can get together in a place, or, you know, we've seen franchises, Tech Shop, grow up. So somebody like Tech Shop can have these tools. People can join and be members. And so there's a lot more that we can learn to do for ourselves, or small business can do for itself in a community. So I have no idea if we're going to get to the point where you go down to Ace Hardware and they just print you off whatever it is you want in their 3D printer. But it certainly means we can bring a lot of this stuff down to a much smaller footprint. And I think, to me, in theory, that could be good news for the small guys.
In addition, I think it's really important, and it does bring up a different concept for those that are involved in this, but if we go down that path and we do retool that as United States and we become strong again in manufacturing, the shift that would be required for the skill for employees is projected that we and whoever else takes this on are going to have labor shortages because there just aren't enough skilled employees at any one specific location, for example, in the United States. So, you know, what they're talking about is if that's the path that we're going to go, you may see multiple manufacturing locations around the world, not because that's the way, even, let's say you're a U.S. manufacturer, and that's not because that's the way you want it, but it's because there aren't enough skilled employees to be able to do the job.
Right. I was when I was in Switzerland last year, somebody sat down next to me, and I asked them what they're doing, and they said, oh, I'm over in Venice, California. I have a grant from the Office of Naval Intelligence. They want me working to encourage low-income communities to get interested in robotics because they project in 10 years they need 400,000 robotics engineers in the United States alone. How's that?
You know, And that's crazy. I saw a report from McKinsey who said that because of the cloud, and we're talking about, you know, manufacturing, or excuse me, needs, there's going to be 1.5 million more data literate managers to be able to help manage that are needed in the next 5 years.
I can believe that. I can believe that. Okay, well, one of the things I'm interested in is how we encourage young people to focus their curriculum on where the jobs are going to be. Well, let's turn to number four, service industries. And this is not one I want to talk a lot about, but I keep looking at what is possible with these different technologies, you know, and so using robotics to literally run all the fast food restaurants with no humans. And my question is, what in the world is this going to do to the employment? And, of course, I think you already answered the question, which is there's going to be a tremendous demand for skilled workers. And it doesn't appear, if you look at the universities or the schools, that anybody seems to be preparing for this.
I agree with you. I don't, you know, I haven't looked at the curriculum in most, but the people that I talk to, I don't see, you know, the kids that I talk to that are in school, I don't see the, you know, those education heading in that direction. Maybe it's just so that, because we're so new in its infancy, that, you know, the education system hasn't quite caught up with the demand or the realization that there's going to be this kind of demand.
Well, there's an incredible disconnect, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how that all gets connected up. Quickly, food and water. This is an area of much frustration because I've been looking for, since 2004, seriously on ways of investing in food through the equity markets. I have to tell you, whenever I see new technology, there's some good stuff being applied to water in terms of companies that help do water remediation and all sorts of other good things with water. But in the food area, I don't even want to talk about new technology because so much of what is happening is really frightening. And you see tremendous, you know, wonderful things happening in the private equity area or in the open source area. But so far, food is one that has eluded me, so I will skip on to energy, which is one that's had a very dramatic impact. The first part of energy that we wanted to touch on was the extraordinary increase in domestic gas reserves, and I'm going to turn and bring up the first slide, as a result of new drilling, so-called fracking technology. Maybe, Chuck, you could just take a second and introduce this.
Is this the, I can't see what you've got up, is this the U.S. oil and natural gas proved reserve chart?
No, I've got the recoverable natural gas reserves globally.
Ah. Okay.
And then I'll go to the historical for domestic.
Yeah, the one thing, you know, when we do our research on this, we find that you're going to get different people telling you different amounts of reserves because they will quantify certain types of reserves differently than other people. But the bottom line is regardless of what the exact number is, there has been a huge expansion of available discovery of natural gas since the fracking and since the shale. It's almost the 60 to 70% growth since the start of 2000. And you know, I suspect this is going to continue to go while our oil has actually, well, we've had an uptick in the last few years, but it's on a gradual decline. It's declined about 30%. But gas is where it's at for the United States, and it has an unbelievable potential for supplying. You know, I don't know if you saw the report, but I think it was IEA that came out and said that there's enough recoverable gas reserves to take care of the next 90 years for all of the United States energy needs.
Right, and we should mention, in fact, that the fracking technology is very controversial in some respects, but the reality is what it's managed to do in terms of making the United States theoretically energy self-sufficient as a financial matter is quite dramatic, and you see that drama played out in the equity markets, both in the energy sector, so it's energy, it's pipelines, but also we had Jim Norman on the Solari report, and he pointed out that 40% of the cost of any U.S. manufacturing is energy. And if you look at the price of natural gas here versus Europe versus Asia, at that time, you know, we were $2, Europe was $7, Asia was $15. That's an incredible competitive advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you imagine not shipping that money over to the Middle East and keeping it here and creating jobs and wealth here? I mean, the potential for wealth creation is unbelievable.
Well, maybe if you could talk a little bit about what LNG is and what's happening with LNG, both in terms of exports and trucking.
Yeah, so LNG is basically just a change in state of gas. So gas is gas. Gas particles, and it's hard. It takes up, you know, a lot of space, and if you apply pressure and temperature to gas, you can change it to a liquid. And so basically it is just the process from converting a gas to a liquid, and gas is much more easily transportable either via trucking or via ship. And so and it's interesting because there is a lot of effort here in the United States, money being put into the ability to be able to convert this energy, convert natural gas into liquid natural gas. And the main reason is because you take a natural gas is currently, I don't know, $3 a cubic foot or whatever it is. And if you can convert that into liquid natural gas, it takes just a little bit of energy, which is a byproduct, of course, of energy. Use some of that energy to convert it. You can ship it overseas to Asia, which is the biggest home for it, and you can make you can double or triple your money. You can get, you know, two to three x the revenue that it costs you to drill and convert and ship. So there's a huge economic benefit and cost benefit for those that have a low cost of access to this energy source here in the U.S.
And it was 2011 that we started to be an exporter, a net exporter.
Yes.
Of gas, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And we've got, you know, it's to the point of where we have so much gas in so many wells without the demand here in the U.S. that, and not enough LNG capabilities, that they've had to just basically turn off the spigot because the demand and they're running out of space to put this excess supply.
Right. Well, so much for peak oil for now.
Exactly. Maybe peak oil, but we have excess gas. Well, that sounds like
right.
A commercial for something. I don't know.
Well, let's turn to renewable energy, because one of the things you've really educated me to is what's been happening with the economics of solar energy. And I think that's worth touching on, because at some point we're coming up on a tipping point when solar could become a lot more important to the energy supply.
Yeah, you know, that's always been one of my loves, because I came from the Silicon Valley, and part of what they did was be able to start off the solar industry. But, you know, I mean, if you step back and you look at it, if we could capture just 1/10,000th of the energy, the solar energy that's striking the Earth, we would have enough energy that we would need for the whole world with no greenhouse gas emissions. So, I mean, the potential is there, and it's unbelievable. And the actual growth of the technology itself, or the improvements in the technology. So solar's been out there for about 31 years or so, and, you know, they've made some projections, and if the current progress continues for one more decade, which seems likely. We're getting up to some theoretical limits, but they said that about silicon too. But they will have created an energy source that is as cheap as coal. And you know what coal does to, you know, an environment to have to mine and to use. And then if that goes on another 10 years, so in 20 years from now, you'll be able to create energy from solar cells that is half the price of coal. So basically you could eliminate the use of coal. Now, I'm not picking on coal. I'm just using that as a reference.
Right.
So, well, I know what we see is this adventure, this ongoing progress of the solar technology. But the one thing that where we are today, and I don't know if any people out there have invested in solar, but it's not been the greatest investment over the past 4 or 5 years or so. And
right.
that's because it's commoditized. And there is no real differentiation. It's just a small difference between supplier A and supplier B. And on top of it, you now have the Chinese, who have a much lower cost of manufacture, jumping in. And so what you have is a huge commodity that is easily manufacturable, that doesn't, you know, it's there's some technology required, but in general, it's not a challenge. It's not like trying to produce an Intel microprocessor. But at some point in time, we're going to have a breakthrough, whether it be through a technological change, a type of solar cell, whether it's gallium arsenide or something different, that's going to give us the breakthrough that we need, and somebody is going to, whoever manufactures or creates that is going to be the big winner.
Okay, so all over the world, we have these huge utilities who
yes.
are doing, you know, coal or doing, you know, but they're big footprint, big monopoly, very powerful, and, of course, they're producing lots of dividends for investors. What happens when this hits the tipping point?
it's as we've always said, it's the death of one, you know, industry and the birth of another. So all
right.
I don't see it will be the death of it. What will happen is you'll see a slow decline of the massive utilities and an increase of whether it be solar or any other type of energy source that's actually cheaper. So it's just a shift, and that shift is going on. It's just it's like turning a tanker. It's going to take a long time to get there.
It was so funny because when we were looking at Apple being equivalent to so many of the European stock markets, I went in and I told you, you know, I want to look at all the French companies. And so I went and looked at all these big French utilities, and I thought, oh, no. I don't think these guys are ever going to be able to adapt to this. So I want to stick with the smaller,
yes.
the smaller guys. Smaller, nimble, newer. Okay, so let's. I just wanted to mention the wild card, of course, here is Breakthrough Technologies. We had Adam Trombley talking about some of them on in the Solaria Report. If you're interested, we're not going to go into tonight. But I did want to mention I'm going to be over in the Netherlands. There's a very interesting conference being brought through to sort of bring leaders in Breakthrough Technologies from all over the world. And so I'm hoping I'll have some kind of report on that, but to me that's a wild card, but I still don't know quite what to make of it in terms of when something real might get integrated. So let's turn to health sciences, because I think it was you, Chuck, who said that if there was going to be one area that would have the most dramatic impact on increase in value in the equity markets, you thought it was probably going to be health sciences. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I still think that's true. You know, I have a bias because I, you know, went through the development and growth and maturation of the, you know, the Silicon Valley, where it was all silicon and computers, and I saw the branch off from that into, and it's taking the same model, it's taking the same path that biotech is taking. And it's unbelievable. What happens is you, whether it's biotech or silicon, you would have a large company, you'd have somebody with a really good idea, they'd go, they would leave, they'd create something new, they'd get some venture funding, and the next large company would, you know, it would then turn into a large company or they'd be bought out. And that's exactly what's happening with biotech. You know, and if you look at the trend from the past 2 years, it's down slightly, but there was $1.5 billion that flowed into the equity markets, you know, startups for just the first half of this year. And if you
wow.
look for the since 1998, there has been on average 100 to 200 venture funded startups and 300 to 400 total biotech fundings, which are both combinations of startups and second round fundings for biotechnology companies. And that's just for venture funding. That doesn't include, you know, the major drug companies and the money that they're pouring into the market. So it's unbelievable the amount of money that's flowing in there and the potential, you know, the potential breakthroughs that are going to be made through this. And of course, once you have a breakthrough, then money's, you know, that's where money can be made in equities.
Well, it's funny. I put it up on the blog because this is one of my favorite sayings that since 2003, silver was up 800%, gold was up 500%,
yeah.
and the leading manufacturer of surgical systems was up over 4,000%, and that kind of brings it home to me. But you know, it's pretty interesting and spectacular what's going on. We mentioned the 3D printer building a new jaw for a woman. And we've seen all sorts of surgical systems you and I have looked at. And, of course, nanotechnology now gives us tiny little devices that go into your body and drip drugs out slowly and then melt away. And
that's right.
This is another one. But one I wanted to mention was the 3D printer that can make a human organ. And if you look at, you can jump on the Internet and do a search for 3D printers and human organs, and what you'll see is, you know, whether at Cornell or MIT or all over the country, people are working on this, but you're literally seeing, you know, the fast way to get a transplant is not to wait for a donor to die, but to turn on the 3D printer. And it was funny, I was out in our office and we were looking at a company that was making such a printer, and I came back to the couple that I was staying with and I told them, and they said, "Oh, that's nuts, you're making this up, this is impossible." And we turned on the TV, and there was a doctor show, and sure enough, they were growing somebody a kidney in the 3D printer. And I said, "Well, see, it's on TV. It must be real." And and then today, I was going over with the Celeria team. We were sort of doing our roundup for the Celeria report tonight, and somebody said to me, "Are you making this up? Is this a joke? Is this for real?" And, of course, I made everybody get on Google and do a search for 3D printer in human organ, and sure enough, they were like, "Oh, my God." This is really happening. So I don't know if you want to say anything more about these different things, but they're, you know, day to day to day, what we're looking at is pretty amazing.
It is. And I it's one of those things, when we first saw that video, when we were looking into that company to see if we wanted to invest in it, it was, you had to laugh, and it wasn't a laugh because of, it was funny. It was a laugh because this is creepy. I'm not sure whether I like this or not.
Except for, I tell you, my uncle was started the transplant center in South Carolina, and you would see people die waiting for a transplant. And to know that they didn't have to die, that you could, you know, you had a way to get something rather than just pray and wait for a donor, to me that's very freeing.
So oh, it is. It's unbelievably impressive in what can be done. It's just, for people that are used to it, or, you know, that, like you were, that were involved in it, I think it's, you know, acceptable, but it's understandable. But for me, it's still a little creepy, and I'm growing this, you know, what's next? You're going to grow a whole human.
Yeah, so what else have they been growing that
exactly.
They haven't told us about?
Exactly.
Okay, so quickly, let's turn to some of the cross-cutting issues. And there are many. We could talk about these forever. But very quickly, one of the things it's needless to say, is that patent law, patent liability, and patent litigation are getting more and more important. And when we look at companies, you know me, I'm always turning to the litigation section. But it makes having the patent, getting the patent, managing the patents, and the value of patents much more important. So for those of you planning on going to law school, you want to look at intellectual property. Another thing is artificial intelligence. How in the world are we going to optimize, find, store, organize, manage, you know, all this different data? And I talked earlier about the risk management. How in the world are we going to get a culture in the software industry that's really committed to very high qualities of flawless performance when the risk issues and the liabilities issues are this great? We talked about the employment model. One of the things I always come back to, which you know is a big concern to me, is the privacy issues. And after sort of getting familiar with where all of this technology was going, including the cloud, I said to one of the people I work with, "Well, we all live in the Truman Show now," in honor of the movie The Truman Show, where Jim Carrey lives and, you know, everything's a camera and it's looking at him. But needless to say, there's a lot less privacy in this world, and a lot more accountability, good or bad. Any thoughts, Chuck, on the cross-cutting issues?
Well, I go back to it's not the cloud, but the managing what they're calling big data, and it's, you know, to me that is going to be a huge challenge that we're going to have, but it's also going to be a huge potential for, you know, we're all looking for where are we going to find growth, because we don't want to go into this stagnation of a country that, you know, that has no path for its kids. And, you know, every day we create 2.5 quintillion, again, that's 18 zeros, bytes of data. And it's so much that 90% of the world's data has already been created in the last 2 years. So basically we're doubling in 2 years. And how do you manage all that? I mean, not only do you talk about the risks that are involved, but how do you manage that? It's going to take an unbelievable amount of resources and smart resources that are going to be able to manage that.
Right, and it's also how do you, as a society, how do you manage an explosion in knowledge as well? Now, obviously, not all data is knowledge, but with this amount of invention and sort of integration of smart technology and all sorts of things, the innovation and the growth in knowledge is accelerating. And so, to me, there's a real social issue of how do you change your culture to live with that higher learning speed and you know, but have a culture that's a wonderful place to be a part of and continues to be human. So these are big questions. And I just want to bring up before we close, our movie tonight is Other People's Money with Danny DeVito, which is a wonderful comedy that explores just these issues. There's a small company, in New England Wire and Cable, run by Gregory Peck, and and Danny DeVito plays Lawrence Larry the Liquidator Garfield, who does a hostile takeover, a hostile tender for Gregory Peck's company. And Peck basically, you know, technology is changing the market, and Peck and his company are not changing with it. And Danny DeVito basically comes in and says, you know, this company's dead and we need to liquidate it. And it's sort of the two sides of the balance sheet having a war. And at the end, it turns out that Gregory Peck's daughter, who Danny DeVito develops, falls in love with, seeks out a Japanese company and says, you know, what we need to do is we need to reinvent the company. So you sort of get the asset side of the balance sheet warring with the financial side of the balance sheet, and then the daughter comes in with the third way, which is a reinvention and reintegration of both, because in fact both are right and both are wrong. One of the things you see in Gregory Peck's defense of his company is the fact that what Danny DeVito is going to do is better for the shareholders, but it's going to just completely knock the town and the taxpayers on their, you know, back on their you-know-what. And so you see all the issues battled out, but it's very cleverly done, and it's very funny. Did you watch the Larry the Liquidator speech, Chuck?
Yes, and I thank you for twisting my arm and sticking the gun to my head to watch that, because that is a classic, and anybody that hasn't seen it, I'm going to hold on to that one. That one I love, I tell you. Thank you.
It's a very, very funny movie, and it battles out all these issues, and it helps you rise above them and get perspective on them. And what's interesting is you watch our entire society grapple with this incredible change. You know, we're getting all sorts of emotional, you know, and we're getting fear, we're getting anger, we're getting crankiness, and to a certain extent, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to do this O'Leary Report, we need to step back and say, you know, maybe what's happening is not just the bad guys. Maybe what's happening is by me getting this iPhone and completely reengineering how I do things and how I pay for things and where my time and money goes, I'm causing a dramatic change throughout the society. You know, and that's what we're seeing. And I love Other People's Money because it kind of takes you up to a higher level and gives you a real perspective on what's happening. And I think, you know, to a certain extent right now, America is just one big metaphor for other people's money. So definitely, definitely watch that movie. Okay, well, before we close, you're going to be back in October, Chuck, with another equity update. But before we go, I know that you spent years and years plowing in and looking at all these different areas and understanding the investment consequences of them. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us before we end in this whole area of technology as a primary trend?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that. I wasn't prepared, but I wasn't prepared. I was hoping you would. The one thing I would just pass is that, you know, from an equity standpoint, new technology does not necessarily equate to meaning it's a great investment. It could, but it doesn't mean that. And so you have to, not only do you have to look at the company, you know, and what they do, but just as importantly, and this, you know, you've taught me this more than anybody, is that you need, the people matter just as much as the technology matters.
Yeah, and in fact, I think when somebody asked me today, you know, is this area going to get pumped and dumped like the internet stocks? One of the things I was thinking about was, okay, how do you protect yourself from that? And I get back to the idea of investing in the primary trend. And to me, the most important thing, Chuck has an expression called a gem. We're still trying to figure out how to define a gem. But a gem is a company that is really extraordinary, not just in terms of the products and services that it provides, but the leadership and the management and the quality of the people and the culture. And I think one of the greatest ways to protect yourself from the pump and dumps and the swings and some of the fraud or crazy stuff that goes on in the, you know, a fashionable business that ultimately never makes sense and doesn't have a sound business model, is to look for that excellence in people and governance and leadership and in culture, because it's really that, to me, it's that excellence that has defined all the really great companies that have translated into really great investments. So I'm still trying to define how to, you know, what it is that defines a gem and how to find a gem, but I think that's what you're looking for. You're looking for excellence in the people, and that's what makes a company great. And it's ultimately, to me, it's the great companies that will be the great investments in this area. So I'm glad you said that. Okay, well, Chuck, thank you very much for joining us, and we will look forward to you joining us in October. And between now and then, I'm going to be on the phone with you 2 hours digging in the dirt for more high-tech truffles.
That's right. Well, we're looking for gems, but thank you for the invitation, and have a great rest of the evening.